Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Biogeography, A Very Short Introduction, by Mark V. Lomolino, narrated by Patrick Lawler. Publisher's note: in this audio edition, you will hear references to figures and tables present in the print and e-book formats of the book. Chapter 1. Biological Diversity and the Geography of Nature. For those trying to make sense of the forces structuring the natural world, biological diversity, the variation in all characteristics of life, from cells to individuals to communities, offers a compelling but often overwhelming source of stimulation and challenge. The challenge lies in the implicit paradox of searching for simple explanations for patterns generated by what are arguably the most complex systems in the universe. The self-organizing biological systems that are the products of billions of generations of engineering during the ecological and evolutionary assembly of our living planet. Throughout history, key insights into understanding the diversity of life and the processes generating it have come from placing natural phenomena within a geographic context. From Alexander von Humboldt and other visionaries of the Age of Enlightenment, through Charles Darwin, Alfred Russel Wallace, and other naturalist geologists of the 19th century, and on to Edward Osborne Wilson, James Hemphill Brown, and other contemporary scientists exploring patterns of variation in life across the planet, all recognized the invaluable clues provided by the geography of life. For ancient civilizations, their very existence depended on knowledge of how food plants, game animals, and other natural resources were distributed across the landscapes and seascapes that comprised their homelands. Authors across a range of literary genres have spoken of the distinctiveness of place, whether homeland or some exotic island or distant continent. Homer spoke of Odysseus and his travels to exotic islands across the Mediterranean, each with their distinctive, albeit mythical, faunas. Gertrude Stein's "There is no there there" is a pointed lament over the loss in the special character of her hometown, Oakland, California, after it had lost its characteristic sights, sounds, and smells to join the homogenizing expansion of urban lands. In the geological sciences, William Smith was the first to unlock the successive buildup of geological formations by discovering the patterns of variation in rock and fossil strata with depth and horizontally across the landscapes of Great Britain. A global-scale model of the evolution of the Earth's crust would await Alfred Lothar Wegener and his theory of continental drift, which again relied heavily on his abilities to place patterns of variation of rock forms, fossils, and other material in a geographic context. The juxtaposition of geological and paleontological evidence from coasts now on either side of the Atlantic led Wegener at the dawn of the 20th century to one of the greatest discoveries in the history of science. His insight that the continents have drifted over time led to the more general theory of plate tectonics, the recognition that the Earth's surface consists of great plates that have been in continual flux since the crust first solidified some 4.5 billion years ago. The geological evolution of Earth has fundamentally influenced the evolution of its life forms, which brings us back to biological diversity and to the central and unifying assertion of this book and of biogeography in general. Just as the distinguished evolutionary biologist and Eastern Orthodox Christian Theodosius Dobzhansky argued in 1973 that nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution, biogeography asserts that many, if not most, of the compelling kaleidoscope of patterns in biological diversity make little sense unless placed in a geographic context. Where do particular species occur? How and why do they vary from place to place? Where did their ancestors occur? How did they spread across the globe? Where are the hotspots of biological diversity? Where can the rarest and most bizarre and most distinct life forms be found today? And how should we apply these insights from the geography of nature to develop successful, spatially explicit strategies for conserving life across the planet? All these questions fall within the realm of biogeography. As Dennis McCarthy observed in Here Be Dragons, biogeography, once a secret delicacy enjoyed only by geniuses, must now be elevated from its current obscurity and placed alongside literature and history as an indispensable component of a truly enlightened education. Globalization of the natural sciences. Modern scientists are only recently developing an appreciation for the scientific knowledge of early civilizations, which, at least in terms of the detailed natural history of the local plants, animals, and environments they depended on, may well have exceeded that of many contemporary natural scientists. This traditional knowledge, after all, was essential to their survival. Itself the product of thousands of generations of cultural evolution and natural selection, this knowledge included not only their abilities to identify hundreds of species they relied on, but also the lessons of where to find them, that is, the geography of life, albeit at a local scale. Early civilizations living in mountainous areas saw, as they turned their gaze toward the slopes, an orderly progression of habitats, each with a predictable yet distinct collection of plants, game species, and other resources. Other populations of our ancestors living in coastal environments developed an intricate and essential knowledge of variation in sea life from shallows to open waters, of the rhythms of the tides and the seasons, and not only how best to harvest, but eventually how to manage and sustain the resources of land and sea critical for their survival. Polynesians and other insular civilizations across the world's oceans developed an intricate knowledge of patterns of life across their islands, a knowledge base that continually expanded as burgeoning populations and dwindling resources drove them to explore and expand their realm to distant archipelagos and new regions. Their discoveries were not only essential to the continued existence of their local populations, but simultaneously expanded their knowledge of the geography of life from local to regional levels. During their voyages, Pacific Islanders no doubt observed patterns among islands that form much of the empirical framework for the modern field of island biogeography. That diversity of plants and animals is higher in larger systems, and that more isolated islands tend to have fewer species and many novel forms not found in their homelands. Polynesians who colonized the most remote systems may well have observed a pattern fundamental to the modern field of biogeography. That different archipelagos, even those with similar climatic and environmental conditions, were inhabited by different plants and animals. This early knowledge of the natural world was foundational to the natural sciences, including biogeography, evolution, and ecology. But for this traditional ancestral knowledge, developed by a mosaic of civilizations, to coalesce into a genuine science of the geography of life, we had to advance along two transformative fronts. First, we had to expand the scale of that knowledge and of our views of nature from local to regional and global levels. And second, we had to develop a conceptual framework of fundamental principles and unifying theory to guide and integrate those advances. Naturgemälde, von Humboldt's holistic portrait of nature. Alexander von Humboldt was one of the world's most remarkable, visionary, and integrative scientists, arguably unrivaled in his holistic view of all human endeavors, including philosophy, art, politics, and government, and, of course, the natural sciences, during the critical foundational period of the 18th century, the Age of Enlightenment and the Century of Philosophy. His books, and in particular the narratives of his travels across the Atlantic and through the tropics of South America, were essential reading for all intellectuals across Europe during the late 18th and early 19th centuries, including Charles Darwin, Alfred Russel Wallace, and a legion of other highly impressionable budding naturalists who were searching for adventures to distant lands in their quest to unlock the mysteries of the natural world. Among all his numerous and visionary contributions, it may be folly to single out any one of von Humboldt's discoveries as most influential in the history of science. Indeed, his greatest influence on advancing science in the broadest sense was not in any particular contribution, but in his approach to all natural phenomena, an approach captured in the German term Naturgemälde. As von Humboldt applied it throughout his life, Naturgemälde directed naturalists and other scientists to view and portray nature in its most holistic form, as a constellation of interconnected phenomena whose patterns can best be envisioned and whose causes only understood when explored in synergy. Von Humboldt's Tableau Physique of Elevational Gradients along the Slopes of Mount Chimborazo in Ecuador is a prototypic exemplar in biogeography, where somehow he simultaneously demonstrated his dedication to meticulous, painstaking detail with his singular visions for grand synthesis across local to regional phenomena. Because of his pioneering influence during this foundational period in the natural sciences, von Humboldt was widely recognized by subsequent generations of scientists as the founder of a long and eclectic list of disciplines, including volcanology, oceanography, anthropology, archaeology, meteorology, geomagnetism, and, most relevant to this book, phytogeography, the geography of plants. Von Humboldt's Tableau Physique is also an exemplar in biogeography because it is a compelling illustration of our central assertion that some of the most complex and potentially confounding aspects of the natural world and of biological diversity in particular are rendered explicable when placed in an explicit geographic context. In this case, the unifying template for von Humboldt's holistic vision of climate, soil, plants, animals, and impacts of humanity was geography, specifically the elevational gradient in all of these properties and processes, which revealed their interconnectedness and the emergent patterns at the grand scale of the entire slope of Mount Chimborazo. Epiphanies of Geography and Evolution. As singular as von Humboldt was in his unique combination of drive and diversity of pursuits, other luminaries in the history of science took an analogous approach to achieve their own epiphanies on the dynamics and complexities of the natural world. Because they studied all the earthly phenomena, natural scientists of the 18th and 19th centuries were often called geologists. Today, we tend to view geology as a science separate from the life sciences, a specialization and compartmentalization of the natural sciences that likely would have vexed von Humboldt. Indeed, some of the most important discoveries in geology were achieved by early naturalists researching a broad array of changes in the structure and composition of rocks and the fossils they contained. As alluded to earlier, William Smith was another luminary in the history of science, but in stark contrast to the wealthy and aristocratic von Humboldt, Smith's life was a long saga of debt and destitution, punctuated, however, with another grand synthesis of how nature works, another epiphany derived from placing a vast collection of local observations in an explicit geographic context. In this case, the observations were on the form and composition of rocks and fossils recorded while Smith surveyed for the mines and canal agencies, and the geographic gradient was not elevation, but depth and distance across the landscapes of Great Britain. Smith was the first to describe and visualize the repeated sequence of rock strata along these two geographic gradients, and to envision how these formations over space chronicled the development of geological formations over time, illustrating all this in a 74 by 105 inch map that would later and justifiably be described as the map that changed the world. Three other exemplars of epiphanies gained by placing complex natural phenomena within an explicit geographic context are those of Charles Darwin during the early to middle decades of the 19th century, of Alfred Russel Wallace later in that century, and of Edward Osborne E.O. Wilson during the 20th century. Darwin and Wallace share credit for simultaneously but independently articulating the theory of evolution by natural selection. To Darwin, the essence of the theory came to him, as the story goes, after regrettably mixing specimens of tortoises from different islands in the Galapagos. He was rescued by a resident of the islands who could identify the source island of each specimen by the peculiarities of its carapace. In isolation on the islands, each with its own distinct environments and selection pressures, those phenotypes best adapted survived and reproduced on that island, ultimately resulting in evolutionary divergence in forms among the islands. Alfred Russel Wallace initially failed in his first attempt to follow in von Humboldt's footsteps as a naturalist explorer, collecting specimens of butterflies and birds of tropical South America. After the devastating loss of his specimens to a shipwreck in the Caribbean, the young and indefatigable Wallace turned despair into triumph by forging off on his life-defining explorations across the Malay Archipelago, Indonesia. Here he spent some 8 years exploring the islands, documenting and describing new forms of plant and animal life, describing their variation among islands, and experiencing epiphanies that led to his independent discovery of the theory of evolution by natural selection, along with a long list of other revelations of how life evolves over space and time. Whereas Darwin spent much of his time and energies on other aspects of evolution, long-distance dispersal, and related subjects, Wallace's central focus was on the geographic variation of nature and the processes driving that variation. Among Wallace's many contributions to the field that would lead him to be recognized as the father of zoogeography, one visual exemplar first published in 1876 revolutionized biogeography, and we continue to use it today. Following observations by earlier geologists and naturalists that different continents are inhabited by assemblages of different species, biogeography's first principle, Wallace realized that each region was a distinct evolutionary arena, each developing its distinctive fauna and flora in isolation and over the evolutionary history of that region and lineage. Like William Smith's exemplar, Wallace's most broadly recognized contribution was another map, but this time one at a global scale and depicting the evolutionary divisions, zoogeographic regions of the world. Over the subsequent decades and up to contemporary times, modern biogeographers have sought to refine Wallace's seminal map and to extend it to other fauna besides vertebrates and to plants and other taxa as well. But his vision of the evolutionary divisions of the world continues to shape our views of how life evolves over space and time. Other exemplary cases in applying the biographer's macroscope for discovering the forces driving patterns in biological diversity are far too numerous to list here and likely in longer books on biogeography, ecology, and evolution. But one other epiphany, in fact one that involves all three disciplines, deserves our attention. It is not hyperbole to describe E.O. Wilson as one of the most influential biologists of the 20th century. He pioneered studies of the systematics, distributions, and ecology of ants, articulated a new synthesis of behavior and evolution, sociobiology, co-developed one of the most influential theoretical models of biological diversity of islands, popularized the term biodiversity, and as much as anyone else of his time, he became an ardent and inspirational champion of the then nascent field of conservation biology. Indeed, Wilson clearly articulated the connections among biogeography, ecology, and conservation biology when he observed that the vastness of the tropical archipelagos also provided the knowledge Wallace needed to conceive the biological discipline of biogeography, which has expanded during the late 20th century into a cornerstone of ecology and conservation. One of Wilson's most visionary and integrative epiphanies came from a series of maps he compiled to describe the distributions of ant species across the islands of Melanesia, archipelagos east of New Guinea and Australia. In his 1994 book, Naturalist, Wilson described how, one January morning in 1959, while I sat in my first floor office, sorting my newly sketched maps into different possible sequences, early evolution to late evolution, I knew I had a candidate for a new principle of biogeography. Wilson's new principle was his taxon cycle theory, which describes a regular series of ecological, evolutionary, and biogeographic changes from colonization of an island by a particular species to its ultimate demise and replacement by new colonists. Fundamental patterns, processes, and unifying principles. The first principles of biogeography are intricately linked to its most fundamental patterns, yet the mutualistic relationship between discovery of patterns in nature and the inference and articulation of fundamental principles from those patterns is seldom appreciated. The observations of the early naturalist explorers were guided by their preconceptions, and it was through the iterative processes of assessing and refining those preconceptions that the conceptual framework, hypotheses, predictions, theory, and first principles of biogeography developed. As I like to muse to my students, empirical observations are essential, but without theory and first principles, we are destined to walk randomly through the forests bumping into the trees. Perhaps surprisingly, the first principles of biogeography and articulation of its most fundamental pattern far predate those developed by Wilson in the 20th century and even those proposed by von Humboldt and later by Wallace in the 19th century. The field's first principle came not from a validation, but from a violation of a then universally held preconception. Georges-Louis Leclerc, Comte de Buffon, was a contemporary of Carolus Linnaeus in the 18th century. Both viewed science as a means to serve the Creator by exploring and understanding his design of the natural world. The prevailing view of nature was that all life forms were perfectly adapted to their local environments, thus generating the expectation that regions with similar environments should be inhabited by the same species. Buffon was the first of the naturalist explorers to systematically reject this preconception and describe the distinctiveness of regional biotas. His observations on the distinctiveness of assemblages of mammals and birds of the tropics in South America versus those in Africa would soon be verified by other naturalist explorers for other groups of species and for other types of ecosystems as well. Buffon's observations, first articulated in the middle decades of the 18th century, would become biogeography's most fundamental pattern and its first principle, now known as Buffon's Law. Different regions of the globe, even those with similar climatic and other environmental conditions, are inhabited by different species. Buffon's law is fundamental to biogeography because it describes the distinctiveness of place in terms of its life forms. It served as the field's first unifying principle because it led to the elucidation of the interacting processes that together explain how each region serves as a distinct evolutionary arena, how life forms that have evolved in one region can disperse and invade another, and how the diversity of life forms is often checked by extinction. It thus follows that Buffon's law would eventually lead us to biogeography's fundamental processes of evolution, dispersal, immigration, and extinction, and to the unifying principle that all patterns we study in biological diversity across space and time are the products of these three processes. Many other factors and processes may have influenced the distributions and diversity of life on this planet, but their ultimate influence on patterns in biological diversity is through their effects on how species and lineages evolve, how they or their descendants disperse to other regions, and how long they survive before ultimately suffering extinction. One final layer of complexity is necessary to complete this overview of the conceptual framework of biogeography, and it is illustrated in the model shown in Figure 4. Biological systems are among the most complex systems we can study, not only because they are the products of millions of generations of evolution, immigrations, and extinctions occurring across scales ranging from local environments to entire continents and ocean basins, but because each of the fundamental processes at all temporal and spatial scales is affected by ecological feedback. That is, the species are not only the products of the fundamental processes, but through competition, predation, parasitism, mutualism, and other more complex multi-species interactions, they strongly influence how other species evolve, disperse, and survive or suffer extinction. Natural experiments and the comparative approach. Biogeographers have tended to be very visual in their approach to exploring nature, with maps serving as the key means of discovering patterns, especially during the early history of the field. As biogeography advanced, we developed more diverse and creative ways of visualizing patterns, including employing computer technology in geographic information systems, GIS, and statistical approaches for analyzing and testing predicted patterns in the geographic variation of life. Much of this progress proved the old adage that necessity is the mother of invention. Despite the compelling nature and insightful powers of our discipline, to be a biogeographer means we are often limited in our experimental approaches. Whereas scientists in other disciplines can control and manipulate experimental treatments in petri dishes, flower pots, microscope slides, or populations of laboratory specimens, biogeographers can seldom, if ever, conduct experimental manipulations at the spatial and temporal scales most relevant to the broad-scale patterns we study. As my distinguished colleague and most influential mentor, James Hemphill Brown, often observes, in biogeography, manipulative experiments are either impractical, impossible, or immoral. Seldom can or should we fundamentally alter an entire biota, destroy a mountain, reduce the size of an island, or connect long-isolated islands, continents, or oceanic basins. What we can do, although lacking in control of manipulations, offers far greater realism in that we can study the patterns at scales most relevant to the processes believed to be in play: evolution, immigration, extinction, plate tectonics, etc. These are processes that operate at broad spatial and temporal scales far beyond those captured in a petri dish, greenhouse, or laboratory experiment. So it is that out of the necessity of seldom being able to employ manipulative experiments, biogeographers have developed myriad creative approaches for testing their hypotheses and advancing theory on how nature works. These include strategies for designing natural experiments, alternative applications of the comparative approach, and an entirely new field and approach to exploring patterns in nature called Macroecology. Great lessons of Earth and the road ahead. It should be clear by now that the field of biogeography is one of the most holistic disciplines of biology, and indeed of all the natural sciences. While the scope of this highly integrative field brings great challenges in our attempts to combine and synthesize insights.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?